We will have presentations that go for right around a half an hour, and then just a little over half an hour, and then time for Q&A afterwards.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure. Hi, for people who have just joined in, this is Elizabeth Crow with Coming Clean facilitating today. We have our speakers ready. We've had a few beeps yet. I think we'll just wait one more minute and then get started. Okay, I think beeps have slowed down, so we can go ahead and get started. If I can ask you all, if you are not a speaker, to mute your phone line, please, it would be great. And we'll make sure that at the end that you're able to unmute your lines to ask any questions after the call. Hi, you just joined?
Rick?
Hi, Rick. Elizabeth. Well, good afternoon, everyone, or good morning yet for anyone on the West Coast. My name is Elizabeth Crow, and I'm facilitating today. I want to welcome you to a Coming Clean News teleconference with folks here from the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance, the Center for Effective Government, Coming Clean, and others who are working on chemical disaster issues. I am the Associate Director of Coming Clean, and I'll be facilitating today. At the bottom of the hour, or as close as we can get to it, we'll open up for the phone lines for questions and discussions with our audience. We welcome you and have invited you on the call to hear about a new report called Who's in Danger? A Demographic Analysis of Chemical Disaster Vulnerability Zones. A link to the new complete report and other information about environmental justice and chemical disasters can be found right at the top of the page at www.louisvillecharter.org. The executive summary, recommendations, and community stories in the report are also available in Spanish on the website, as are images that you may wish to use in your stories. Paul Oram, our lead researcher and co-author of the report, and Sean Moulton from the Center for Effective Government are both on the line as well and are available for questions when we break for Q&A. Later on this call, you'll meet Dr. Robert Bullard, Dean of the Barbara Jordan Mickey Leland School of Public Affairs at Texas Southern University and author of the seminal reports, Dumping in Dixie, and Toxic Waste and Race at 20, which first documented the connection between race and the location. We'll also hear from Richard Moore, a local co-author of the report from the Los Jardines Institute and national co-coordinator of the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance, who will discuss the action recommendations made in the report. Dr. Henry Clark from the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, California, will describe the chaos when 15,000 people had to flee the terrible Chevron refinery fire there and go to area hospitals with respiratory distress. Judith Nieto is with the Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services, or TEJAS, and will tell us what it's like growing up with the threat of chemical disasters and how it is now for the people of the Houston Ship Channel when any of the many chemical facilities in the Houston Ship Channel explode or catch fire. But first, I want to invite Michelle Roberts, National Co-Coordinator of the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance and a co-author of the report, to speak. She is an organizer who has spent a lot of time serving communities throughout the U.S., especially the Gulf region's chemical disaster-prone areas. And she will now tell us about the findings of the report.
Wilson Dysart, Al Jazeera America.
Hi. Thanks, those of you who have just joined the call. We're just getting started, and we'll now hear from Michelle Roberts with the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you all for joining us as we release this historic report. Today, we want to share information with you from our Environmental Justice and Health Alliance, and I want to actually set the tone by providing data that actually impacts real people, everyday people. Key findings from this report identified the fact that residents of fence line zones have average home values of 33% below the national average. We also found that average household incomes in the fence line zones are at 22% of the national average. In addition to that, the percentage of Black African Americans living within the fence line zones is 75% greater than for the United States as a whole, while the percentage of Latinos in the fence line zone is 60% greater than for the U.S. as a whole. In addition, the percentage of adults in fence line zones with less than a high school degree is 46% greater than that for the U.S. as a whole, and the percentage of adults in fence line zones with a college or post-secondary degree is 27% lower than for the United States as a whole. Last, the poverty rate in the fence line zones is 50% higher than that of the United States as a whole. These are very disturbing figures that we've received in our research with this report. And again, this represents the many faces that many of you see daily. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. I'd like to welcome folks who have just joined the call and want to remind you, if you can, to mute your lines to help avoid background noise. We just heard from Michelle Roberts from the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance, who presented the findings of the report, and will be able to address more detailed questions after the presentation. But next we'll hear from Judith Nieto, a community organizer with the Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Service, or TEJAS. Judith, could you please tell us what it was like growing up as a child with the threat of chemical disasters in the Houston-Manchester neighborhood? Who are the people living literally under the shadows and threats of chemical disasters in the Houston Ship Channel? And can you describe what has happened to those folks when there's been a chemical facility explosion or fire? Judith, are you on the line?
Hello?
Hi, Judith. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for joining us. Sorry, I was having problems with the muting. Hi. I'm from Houston, Texas, and I grew up in the community of Manchester, which is in the toxic east end of Houston. So growing up there, we experienced many different kinds of smells, many different kinds of health effects. I grew up with asthma. We have constant nosebleeds on several occasions, especially with the children. And it was actually, for me, it was one of the first paradigm shifts that I experienced as a child, coming from Mexico, where it's just quite beautiful, and coming into a neighborhood that is completely surrounded by industry, and a little bit hard to deal with the new sounds, the new smells, and the air being so hard to breathe. After a while, you become sort of accustomed or used to the smells, or really you just lose that sensibility in your nose from so many chemicals that you no longer are able to pick up the smells. So those are sort of the impacts that we are left with growing up in a community like that. When I say there's also sounds, we deal with different kinds of alarms that go off every other day or almost every day during the night and during the day that we don't always know why they're sounding. They're either tests or they're from nearby refineries that might be having an emergency, and really there's no transparency between the industry and the community, where we do not know what's in the air, first of all, and we don't know why the emergency alarms are sounding. So people in Manchester, or communities like Manchester in the east end of Houston and the other surrounding communities, live in a sort of trauma incident happening and not being told what to do in case of an emergency. We also are not trained to react in case of an emergency, because really Manchester would not have time to evacuate all its residents. So shelter in place is one of the things that the industry encourages and the facilities encourage, but really, like the report shows, it's really a desperation strategy and not a plan for public safety or preventing a chemical disaster. So it doesn't really work for us, and living under the fear of a chemical explosion is an everyday thing for people. And we also deal with certain booms that we feel that sound and feel like a small earthquake, that really none of the industry and facilities are taking responsibility for, and they are not notifying people of where these booms are coming from. So that's also a new recent fear that's come into the neighborhood, where in case of an incident, we would not be notified where it started. And it would create a domino effect around all the other facilities that are surrounding the neighborhood. So that draws a picture for people that don't know communities such as Manchester. So it's been a challenge to also enforce some sort of transparent regulation with the industry and try to get this kind of information to the residents and inform them of the vulnerability that they're living in and the vulnerable area that they're in. So this is also something that the community is not very aware of, is the vulnerabilities that we are under. And there's a need for people living in communities like ours to be able to breathe quality air and drink quality water, and to have a peace of mind with respect to the environment. And it's not something that is being provided by either the agencies or the industry that are set to protect us. So, I say that, to really draw a picture for people who have no experience in living up, growing up in a community like that, and the constant fear that people are under is very sad, but also very almost empowering, because there are people who are really mad and really really adamant about trying to speak up and advocate for these regulations that could potentially help the communities like Manchester. And we just recently started refining the tar sands in Manchester, near the nearby industry, that we really don't know what kind of health effects it'll really bring into the neighborhood and into our homes. So that's another issue that a lot of people have not really heard about, because it's so closed in and kept away from the public. And yeah, this is one of the, these are one of the, some of the things that we deal with. We also recently had a ship channel spill where a large barge carrying tar-like oil spilled into the Houston ship channel. And we are still dealing with the effects of that. That just happened recently, about a month ago. And, you know, the industry is not really disclosing the information of what kind of oil was spilled into the Gulf and into the ship channel. So that's another thing, another burden that we're having to deal with in the community. And thank you.
Thank you so much, Judith, for sharing those experiences and really for painting that picture for us. Thank you so much. Before we go on to the next speaker, let me remind folks, if you can, to mute your lines if you're not speaking. You can do this manually by pressing star 6 to mute and then pressing star 6 again. Thank you so much. And now we'll move our focus to Richmond, California, where Dr. Henry Clark is the Executive Director of the West County Toxics Coalition. Dr. Clark, can you tell us who lives in your community and what your personal experience was when the Chevron refinery there caught fire? How has your community been impacted since that time?
Yes, greetings, everyone. Dr. Henry Clark, from the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, California. I'm on the front line of the toxic chemical assault, as we say, because of the fact that I live next to the Chevron refinery, not more than a block away from my community. I was born and raised there in North Richmond next to the refinery, so I knew all of these problems from first-hand experience, the fires and explosions over the years, culminating with the August the 6th, 2012, big fire and explosion that sent over 15,000 people to local hospitals, even though the incident was reported in the media that only about 100 people were affected, which was not correct. It was over 15,000 people. I was directly affected myself. I had a serious a cough and respiratory problem for about a week after that incident. It was the worst accident that I have experienced in all of my 69 years of living there in the Richmond area. There's a lot of respiratory problems in my community, childhood asthma. A lot of the senior citizens have respiratory problems. I have had to bury several of our members over the years that died from some form of respiratory cancer that they strongly believe was associated with chemical exposure from the Chevron refinery. My community is primarily Afro-American and Latinos, which are comprised of the population there in the North Richmond area, a low-income community. And this is a deadly situation there, not only with the Chevron refinery, but when you consider all the other chemical companies and hazardous waste companies in our community, you're talking about a community that is disproportionately impacted. And the report, Who's in Danger, that we are releasing clearly brought home the point to me that communities throughout the United States, similar to mine, you know, is on the front line of the chemical assault, and that is no exaggeration. Playgrounds just cross the fence from chemical companies and refineries, you know, and the variety of health impacts. This is what I call environmental racism, because there's no stretch of the imagination that all of these facilities, the 20 largest facilities in the Richmond area, is located in and around communities where 70 to 75% of the population is Afro-American, and 20 to 25% of the population live below the poverty line. And I'm seeing this here pattern, as indicated in our report, all over the country. So, you know, it's no way I could believe that this just happened to be an accident or coincidence that low-income communities of color are on the front line of the chemical assault. In addition to this disproportionately impacted, you know, in my opinion and assessment, these are human rights violations, period, because these low-income communities of color are targeted for these type of polluting facilities because they may be less organized and don't have the political clout. But we are fighting back, as this report that we are releasing today indicate, and we will continue to do so until this disproportionately impact is reduced, that the regulatory agencies and elected officials are required that these companies in our community invest some of their profits into reducing the risks to our residents, and stop this ongoing disproportionate human rights violations from continuing to occur. As we say in the environmental justice movement, if the government don't, the people will. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Clark. Next, we're going to hear from Richard Moore, who is a report co-author and national co-coordinator of the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance, and is also the coordinator of the Los Jardines Institute, or the Gardens Institute, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Richard, can you tell us what the report recommendations are to protect communities of color from chemical disasters? Richard, are you available?
We're having just a slight technical difficulty, Elizabeth. He'll be right there.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, this is Richard Moore. How's everyone doing?
Great, go ahead.
I just want thank you. Thank you. I wanted to begin my short comments by making a statement in regards to some of the comments that were previously made. As I mentioned, my name is Richard Moore. As Elizabeth introduced us, I'm from Los Jardines Institute, the Gardens Institute in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm also a national co-chair of the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance for Chemical Policy Reform. I think some of you on this call may also know me in my previous work as chair of the National Environmental Justice Advisory Committee to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. You know, I wanted to just say that in our report, that also you see very, very clear that we use an example of something that can be done. And one of those examples in our report is Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the transitioning off of those chemicals within the municipal sewage plant in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I'm saying that to you all because this can be done. It's been done. Transitioning can happen. And so on, and we've got many or several examples to back that up. As you all know, we are presently in Washington, D.C. with a delegation of folks from Louisiana, West Virginia, California, Texas, and New Mexico. We're also traveling with our delegation here with our technical experts, and quite frankly, we've proven our case. They say to us over and over again, you folks are not solution people. You come to us, you explain situations to us in terms of your community, but you never offer us solutions. So very clearly in this document, you can see the recommendations that have been made. We're meeting with elected officials while we're here. We're also meeting with the Department of Homeland Security, with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and Department of Labor, particularly with the representatives from OSHA. And additionally, as I said, we're meeting with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. What we need now is immediate relief for many of these situations that our workers and communities are being exposed to. How many people have to die? We've said this over and over again to our government and to the Obama administration. How many workers have to die? How many community people that live close and next to these facilities have to die? We think the time to act is now, and we must act now. And you all know that there was another incident that took place yesterday while we've been here in Washington, D.C. What we're calling on is policy. We need guidance. We need regulations. We need standards. We need legal footing to prevent many of these situations that are taking place. And we need policy that's implemented that is effective, affordable, and we believe it's available. We believe that some of the technology is very, very clearly, as we explained our case while we've been here, that there is technology that's available at the present time. So again, based on that, we are calling on the U.S. government and its our elected officials, Congress, local, city, and state, and federal authorities to act now to prevent these situations. So I would like to leave it there. Again, I'd like to thank you all for joining us. We hope you've all had the opportunity to read the report. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Richard. And last but not least, we have a legend in the environmental justice and health movement, Dr. Robert Bullard, here with us today. He is Dean of the Barbara Jordan Mickey Leland School of Public Affairs at Texas Southern University. Dr. Bullard is author of the seminal reports, Dumping in Dixie, and Toxic Waste and Race at 20, which first documented the connection between race and the location of toxic sites. Dr. Bullard, can you relate how environmental justice and civil rights overlap with chemical disasters and their threats to communities of color?
Thank you very much. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Okay, good. It's very important to recognize the findings in this report, Who's in Danger, Race, Poverty, and Chemical Disasters. And this report really is a continuation and a documentation of the fact that race and place are interrelated, and the fact that some communities are placed at greater risk than others, and the fact that communities of color and low-income communities are disproportionately on the fence line with these dangerous chemical plants and the facilities that offer great harm if there's an explosion, accident, or some type of a disaster resulting from a terrorist attack. And so, as it turns out, the right to breathe clean air and to be in a community that's free from environmental harm at elevated rates is a basic civil right, and it's a human right. And the fact that low-income communities and communities of color who are on the fence line are underprotected, and they basically have the fact that their rights are not the same as others who can drive in and drive out, and who can escape, you know, a disaster if a plant blows up by not being close by. And so these are basic civil rights and basic human rights that oftentimes are not equally protected under our Constitution. And so when we talk about the fact that whose communities are at risk and the level of equal protection that's being enforced, we can see there are big gaps. And so I think this report, this new report, Who's in Danger, it's pretty clear from the findings that the people that are most in danger are also the people who have the least amount of resources and also who may not have access to private automobiles and may have to depend on public transit for their transportation, who may be high concentration of people who are uninsured, where there are elevated health risks and health and illnesses because of asthma and respiratory illnesses and diabetes and heart disease, et cetera, which in many cases may be linked to or related to living close to these facilities that's emitting dangerous chemicals, over and beyond the fact that there are potentials for accidents and explosions. So to put it in a human rights and a civil rights context, the fact that all communities in this country are not created equal. There are some that are more equal than others. And if a community happens to be poor or a community of color and living next to these facilities, it's receiving less protection and unequal enforcement. And I think that is something that needs to be addressed with more stringent regulations and more stringent enforcement of our laws that are currently on the books, as well as strengthening the laws to make sure that all Americans receive equal protection, and that none of our communities become expendable, and none of our communities become sacrificed communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bullard. Now we've come to the end of the presentations and are going to make our presenters, as well as Paul Oram or Sean Moulton, who are also on the line, accessible to reporters for questions. To unmute your line to ask a question, please press *6. And if you can, go to the website for a link to the full report with materials in Spanish, images, and the information on President Obama's executive order on chemical security at the top of the page. You can find all of that at www.louisvillecharter.org. So now if you are a reporter on the call and have a question, now is your time. Please, if you would, tell us your name and the name of your media outlet when you'd like to speak. Who wants to ask the first question?
Charles Holman, Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, and this is for anybody on the panel, but especially Dr. Bullard or Ms. Roberts. How much effect did these industries' lobbyists have on keeping the dangers to be accurately or effectively looked at?
Thank you for the question. I'm going to ask Michelle Roberts to answer that first, and then Dr. Bullard, if you have something to add, that would be great. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
If you could speak up a little bit, that'd be great.
Okay. Hello. Yes. The industry lobby has placed millions of dollars to push back against regulations that would better protect communities in harm's way. It's not just that of the chemical security bill, but also that of the Toxic Substances Control Act as well, whereby 86,000 chemicals are currently on the market as we speak. And the bills that are actually on Capitol Hill right now that are supposed to be addressed as protecting the communities that Dr. Bullard just laid out for us is actually the worst bill ever. It does not address hot spots. It does not address legacy pollution. The money actually pushed back on even with respect to the medical gag rule, even preempting good state policies. So there is a lot of industry money currently out to block any and all means to protect those in most harm's way. And that's a very huge issue given the fact that they are willing to spend so much money to at least, again, in this report, where we have found at least more than 134 million people are in danger zones. That's unconscionable.
Thank you, Michelle. Dr. Buller, did you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, only thing I'd want to say is I think this is why Who's in Danger report is so important, and the importance of the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance for Chemical Policy and Reform, an NGO organization, to produce a report that documents and gives the facts, because there's no way for organizations out there and non-governmental organizations out there and fence line communities out there to match dollar for dollar in terms of the lobbying. But what our organizations can do is provide information and facts to counter the information that's out there. So I think that's important, one of the major importance of this report.
Great. Thank you for the question. Does anyone else have a question?
Dave Reynolds from
Hello?
I heard Dave Reynolds. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. I guess my question was, I had the woman from Houston talked about how people in communities close to industrial plants don't have information about what the threats are or how to prepare for them. And I guess as I've listened to some of the representatives of the government agencies talk publicly about implementing the president's executive order, they've talked a lot about trying to strengthen the Community Right to Know Act and the local community groups, more so than I've heard them talk about changing chemicals that could be causing the threat. And I was wondering, one, what you think of those ideas that have been discussed, like in EPA officials' testimony last month, that for strengthening the Community Right to Know Act, and whether there's a concern that they may be going that way with the executive order as opposed to the idea of trying to switch out hazardous chemicals.
Thanks. Great question. Richard Moore, I wonder if you would like to answer that one.
Well, I think, and I thank you for that, Dave. And I think this is a very, very important question that's being asked here. One, we consistently have informed the government and its administration, that they have the authority, they have the power right now to implement policy through the Clean Air Act, and they've got it. It's written, it's stated within the Clean Air Act, and we're asking them to implement that authority and power now. The other thing I think that goes along with that, again, with the example that you're saying, it's reminding me of an incident that took place in my own community in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We were told, actually, by local county officials when this fire took place that everything was fine, that they called the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in Region 6, that the region was alerted of this situation, and that that our community and those living in it was fine. Then we ended up calling the EPA ourselves, Region 6, to come to find out that no one was ever informed by the county government or by the city government, and the EPA said very clearly that they were never contacted by any local authorities from environmental agencies from the county or the city. I think the other thing with that, in terms of the use of inherently safer technology, I mean, again, it's there. I mean, I gave an example of a facility that transitioned off of chlorine that was causing both health impacts on our neighborhood, but causing other major situations for our community and so on. So I think very clearly they have it. We're not calling on band-aid approaches to this. We know very, very clearly that that enforcement is important, and many of the other issues that they're talking about at the present time. But they have the power, they have the authority, the time to act now, The time is to act now, and they need to move forward in terms of implementing that process.
Thank you, Richard. I wonder if Paul Oram would also mind responding to that. Paul is a researcher and policy advocate for many, many years on Right to Know.
Yes, Dave, it's an excellent question. But basically, I wanted to chime in that the Right to Know and safer technologies are interrelated and not separate. People have a right to know not only about problems, but as we point out in our report, also about solutions. The solutions that start on page 35 of the report and that we've documented, the many ways to simply remove these hazards, which makes facilities less attractive for terrorists and less prone or simply remove the possibility of a worst-case accident. Our regulations should generate these solutions, and we have the right to know, and people have the right to know about solutions, and the federal government needs information on these solutions. So if EPA and others are talking about right to know, that is also what we think they should be talking about.
Thank you so much, Paul. Next question.
This is Lizzie Grossman writing for the Pump Handle. And I was wondering if in the research for this report, any of you also looked at how many community residents also may be working in the plants or any of the industries and facilities that are posing these risks? Because I'm really curious to get a sense of, you know, what impact, sort of those double impacts there might be to people who are working in the plants and living in the communities and perhaps bringing workplace hazards directly home in to their families, as well as the ambient air exposures.
This is
great. Thank
Paul
you, Lizzie.
Oram.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
I can answer that only briefly. We generally did not delve into that a great deal, but if you do look on page 10 of the report, we did estimate, based on the reports that the companies submitted to EPA, that approximately 400,000 full-time equivalent personnel work at the sites, which are covered in our report. And you are absolutely correct that those who work at the sites tend to get hurt first and worst. They therefore have the most to gain through safer technologies. That's also why a number of major labor unions have been supportive of that approach.
Thank you, Paul. I wonder if Dr. Clark would want to add to that, or Judith from Houston, about people who live in community but also who work at these facilities and what you know of their experiences and that of their families.
Yes, this is Dr. Henry Clark. In regard to the workforce at the Chevron refinery there, from what I understand, that out of a permanent workforce, about 1,300 employees, only about 5% of those employees live anywhere in the city of Richmond at all. Most of the employees live outside of the city, and this has been a problem all my life. I can clearly remember like in the morning when the workers would be going to work there at the refinery. They would be coming through my community of North Richmond, and the streets just would be clogged up with cars and diesel trucks going to the refinery in the same way in the evening after work. And so those workers were collecting those paychecks and heading out to some other community. They was not stopping in our community and spending money in our community, yet we took the risk, as I say, is that, the Chevron and the workers, they left all the way to the bank depositing their paychecks, and we as a community cry all the way to the graveyard burying our people from the chemical exposure.
This is Dr. Bullard. Could I comment?
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to give you the national trend in terms of what happens with these types of facilities. in many cases, the fence line communities, that is, the people that are closest to the physical plants, don't get the jobs. They are disproportionately impacted environmentally. But if you talk about the impacts, the negative impacts are localized, whereas the benefits are more dispersed. People generally drive in, drive out, and as Dr. Clark said, take their paychecks with them to their homes. And the people who are closest could actually walk to work, but disproportionately, some of those families don't have cars, and so they live close by with no grocery stores, no economic development, and in some cases, no hospital. And so when people talk about this argument that these high-paying manufacturing jobs in these industries, they are high-paying, and but they don't pay for a disproportionate share of those families that live next door.
Thank you. Elizabeth, I just wanted to add a quick comment
if I could.
Go ahead, Richard.
We've been meeting, and many on this call know, we've been meeting with labor, with many of those workers and so on. And our report very clearly talks about our concern and support both for communities and workers that are working in those facilities. Additionally to that, I think we should very clearly understand the emergency responders and some of the others that are workers too. Many a times when these incidents are taking place in our neighborhoods, those emergency responders that are coming in, they're not given the kind of information that they need to even know in many cases what kind of situations that they're coming into. So in a broad sweep of that, we need to look at all communities, those that are surrounding the facilities. We see the vulnerability zones, where it starts off 100, 500, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, and keeps on going within the circles in terms of our reports and so on. But I did want to add to that in many situations, many of those workers that are coming in as emergency responders are not aware of the situations that they're coming into themselves.
Thank you, Richard. Are there other questions?
I have one more, Charles Harmon, Minnesota Post Recorder. With the fractured Congress that we have and with the midterm election this year, what do you see, any progress in this issue when you have two sides doesn't seem to want to work together to do anything, let alone saving people's lives?
Excellent question. I'd like to see if Michelle Roberts would have a first crack at that. Michelle, are you there?
Hi, I'm sorry. Can you just repeat that for me? I just had a problem hearing you.
Basically, I asked with the Congress and the President doesn't seem to get along at all, and there seem to be so much fracture back and forth, and with the midterm elections, do you see any progress being held when you're dealing with people's lives?
You know, that is a very good question to ask, and thank you so much for asking that. We are actually dealing with that type of an issue right now in Charleston, West Virginia. There are many in Charleston who are still in harm's way. We just learned, actually, just as recent as last Monday, that 100,000 people, 100,000 people are still sick, and over 300,000 people are without water. And the best way to address issues today, we find that the president has to issue executive orders. We cannot get policies to better protect folks, but the president has to go a step beyond to push and threaten through executive orders. And we all know with executive orders that they are basically, they don't have the teeth and the full protection that many people need to in order to protect them. Just as just like the executive, with respect to the executive order on the chemical facility security, we need action. You know, with this is a very good first step, as many communities have said. However, the steps need to be followed by teeth, action, and action that can be enforceable.
This is Paul Oram. Can I add to that?
Sure.
Starting, it was an excellent question. Starting on page 6 and 7 of our report is a section we call current opportunities. And while Congress is somewhat gridlocked, there is a great opportunity with the administration under Executive Order 13650, Improving Chemical Facility Safety and Security. It should be pointed out that the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Homeland Security have authorities that they have not used effectively to require and encourage changes at chemical facilities that can address many of these hazards by removing them. The interagency report on that executive order is due to the President approximately at the end of this month, and we are hoping that it will include many of the things that we are advocating.
Elizabeth, if I can. Again, I think this is Richard Moore. I think that's a very important question. And as we commented earlier, understanding the gridlock, our communities and workers should not be held hostage or in a situation of political football at the expense of the lives of those workers and those that are surrounding and living in these vulnerability zones. Yesterday in a meeting that we had with the administrator of the U.S. EPA, we reminded herself and those that were present in the meeting that the EPA has the authority to act now through the Clean Air Act. We've got it. It's in there. We don't need Congress in terms of that situation right now. The EPA has the power and the authority to do that. So we need the EPA to move, and we need them to move now. Now that that's been said, then we also need this administration. We need the administration. If the recommendation, which we hope that it does, is moved within the U.S. EPA to the administration to sign off on that. They have the power. The EPA has the authority, and so on, to implement it through the Clean Air Act. So thank you for that very important question.
Thanks, Richard. I noticed when Charles asked his question that there was another reporter speaking as well. Is there another question?
Yeah, this is Doug Guarino from National Journal. To follow on sort of to that last question, is your sort of assumption based on, you know, the meetings that you folks are having, you know, on the Hill and with the administration that the likelihood of getting some of these IST requirements actually in place, that it's more likely that this will be done or could be done through this process, you know, with the EPA under the executive order than it is through the DHS bill that's currently moving on the Hill? There, you probably know that there were some Democratic amendments that tried to add some IST stuff to the DHS bill. So far, those have been shot down by Republicans in the House, although it's, you know, yet to go to the full House and the full Senate. But I just kind of sort of wanted to get your sense as to kind of what the lay of the land is from the way you see it, and, you know, what the prospects are. I gather what you're saying is that it's more likely to get something through the administration at this point.
Thank you for the question. Richard, I wonder if you'd address that again.
Well, again, let me make this comment. Previous administrator Christine Whitman, when she was ahead of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under the Bush administration, I think many of you are aware, moved that process through the U.S. EPA. through the Environmental Protection. It went all the way to the White House, and then based on that, the National Chemical Association or Society moved to block that, and so President Bush at that particular point refused to sign on to the recommendations made by the administrator. So I say this not to you all as rhetoric. We said this before. I mean, and I'll say it in response to this again, how many of us have to die? How many of us have to die? And again, I say that, not as we said yesterday in the meeting with the administrator. We said today in our meetings with Senator Udall, tomorrow with the staff of Senator Boxer and the other elected officials that we're meeting with. That's not rhetoric to us. That's reality. Every day or every week we see one or two more incidences and so on. So I think your question is real there. We would hope at the end of the day that that our communities and workers are not used to be held hostage by the Congress or as political football, as I say, in those maneuvering. Very clearly we're calling on the administration to fully implement the Clean Air Act for the protection of workers in our communities.
What's your view on the DHS bill that's moving through Congress right now? I mean, do you see that as something that's just being done by, you know, supporters of industry to kind of sort of make it look like something is being done but without any real teeth, or what's your thoughts on that?
Is that to Richard Moore?
I think it's to anyone, Elizabeth.
Okay. Paul, would you like to address that?
Yes. Am I muted or unmuted?
We can hear you.
Okay. I think you effectively captured my sense of that bill. It does not include any effective provisions to really solve this problem. I think it's a somewhat fraudulent bill. I think that, you know, a major incident that kills thousands of people could happen at any time, because under that bill, for example, materials that are protected at a chemical site by fences and guards could simply go out in a rail car and be entirely unprotected, in fact, under subsidy from the U.S. government. We think that we are in the right position on this. We hope that Congress and the administration will act before there's some big incident. But if a big incident does occur, it will obviously, you know, show the problem with the current approach. It's really not in the long-term interest of the chemical industry to have these immense hazards in communities. And at some level, I don't understand the opposition to evolving to safer and more secure alternatives. That being said, I think we are in the right position on this, and we'll continue to advocate for it.
Thank you, Paul.
The goal is to reduce and eliminate the vulnerability zones that we have documented in our report to the benefit of all the people who are living within those vulnerability zones, working there, or otherwise visiting there.
Thank you, Paul. And I'd like to ask Judith, if I could, just kind of based on the last couple of questions, to just share with us some of the experience you've had previously talking with your legislators from the Houston area, and from any meetings that you've had just yesterday and today in Washington, D.C., what kind of messages are you delivering to these legislators and to the administration on behalf of your community?
Hello?
Judith, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. If you could speak a little louder, that'd be great.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, what the messages that I'm bringing is basically that, you know, we need support to have even the conversation about relocation and talking about what do we still need to do to be able to be heard? And the experiences that I've had in Houston with my representatives have really not been very helpful, because they also have their own agendas that, you know, it's an oil town there. So when we mention relocation, or we mention better regulations, or even air monitoring, they sort of steer away from those kind of conversations, because, you know, a lot of the money that comes into the city is funded by the industry, and it's strategic. You know, that's where the city probably gets all of their funds from, and it's been a challenge, and it's been a hard journey for me personally, just having to hear these kind of conversations where we are not necessarily part of the planning or part of any of the focus of safety in our communities. So, you know, I'm an advocate for this change that we're asking for, this prevention and enforcement and regulations and things that already exist and technologies that already exist that could potentially save millions and thousands of people in our neighborhood and in our communities. So, I mean, it's still an ongoing struggle for me personally to just sit in some of the meetings and hear the conversations that, you know, these people that really control our fate are having, sometimes without the guidance of community members and without their voices or any of their input. So what I plan to bring back to my community is more of the education about, you know, what the language is being used in making these regulations and the language that, you know, is not always understood very well by community members. So, you know, I like to say that I'm always still learning how to also navigate this system to where I can be a better advocate for my community.
This is Michelle.
Thank you so much, Judith.
If I can just add one additional piece to that.
Yes, go ahead, Michelle.
Hi. And so, as you know, I'm the national co-coordinator for the Alliance, the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance. And this week, we were setting up for the Alliance, setting up the Hill visits to meet with the various members of Congress that our delegation, who were representatives of our delegation. The only representatives that failed to return our request to meet was actually Congressman Gene Green out of Texas. And so we reached out to him many times. But again, as we speak right now, his staff has failed to return a response to us for a request to meet to present them with this report.
Thank you for that note, Michelle. Well, we've reached the top of the hour, and I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today to discuss the report, Who's in Danger? A Demographic Analysis of Chemical Disaster Vulnerability Zones by the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance, the Center for Effective Government, and Coming Clean. The new report and other information about environmental justice and chemical security and additional materials can be found at the following website, www.louisvillecharter.org. Thank you to Dr. Bullard. Thank you to Richard Moore, to Dr. Henry Clark, to Judith Nieto, and that's spelled Judith with a Y, and to Michelle Roberts with EJHA. I also want to thank Paul Oram and Sean Moulton for their work and for being on the call today. Please visit www.louisvillecharter.org for more information on chemical disasters and environmental justice. For additional media assistance, you can contact Joaquin Sanchez with the Los Jardines Institute at 917-575-3154. Or Joaquin Sanchez Jr. at gmail.com, or Stephanie Hendricks with Coming Clean
at 415-258-9151. I'm Elizabeth Crowe from Coming Clean. Thank you so much for joining us. And if you need any assistance to speak with any of the speakers on the call today, please be in touch. And have a good afternoon. Thank you.
Thanks. Sí, ¿verdad?
Tengo que escucharla, no la he escuchado. ¿Sí? Bueno, vas a tener que enseñar ahora, ¿no? Porque ahora, ahora voy a acompañar a Liz en un momentico, pero... ¿Ella tiene algún video o algo así en YouTube o algo así? La ra 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 ra.
We will have presentations that go for right around a half an hour, and then just a little over half an hour, and then time for Q&A afterwards.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
I know you love yourself some
Hi, for people who have, we will have presentations that go for right around a half an hour, and then just a little over half an hour, and then time for Q&A afterwards.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
I know you love yourself
Hi, for people who have just joined in, this is Elizabeth Crowe with Coming Clean facilitating today. We have our speakers ready. We've had a few beeps yet. I think we'll just wait one more minute and then get started.